Hi, and welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We are broadcasting from two repurposed shipping containers at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn today, and we are actually sitting under a farm. There was a garden, now it's classified as a farm. Due to the amount of food that's being produced, it's now considered by New York State a farm, on top of the containers that produces food for the restaurant, right here in industrial Bushwick, Brooklyn. Now that's agricultural vision. There's veggies, herbs, and even grapes on top of the shipping containers. Today's sponsor is Whole Foods Market. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are the garden designers and proprietors of Groundworks, Inc. We design, build, and maintain gardens in the city of New York and the surrounding area. And our show, We Dig Plants, we aim to increase the knowledge and love of plants and all their daily uses. And today we're going to talk about one of our favorite topics, Alice, our profession. Now, we haven't really talked about this very much.
That's with a capital P.
With a capital P. And Alice and I like to think of gardening as the second oldest profession.
What's the first?
I'll leave that to the listener's imagination. I can only talk about topics that I personally
engage in
and have on my resume.
Good rule of thumb.
Yes. So we think of it as a professional occupation, not just a hobbyist or guerrilla backyard do-it-yourselfer. So we're talking about gardener as profession. Now, when I was thinking about this, I observed that in our culture, to be a cop, a lawyer, or a doctor is to have arrived. You'll notice that there are endless shows, mostly, in my opinion, bad and some mediocre, that revolve around these three professions.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's a few that kind of sort of spin off from those of this core group. There's shows about nurses. There's shows about EMS. There's shows about firemen. There's shows about politicians. But they are all ultimately linked to the big three, doctor, lawyer, and cop. So I thought if aliens observed us only via our media as a way of understanding our species, they would conclude that those were the noblest of professions, perhaps the only ones worth pursuing. And I look,
unless, of course, you're watching PBS.
Right. And who's watching that anymore?
You.
I am. I know. I'm in the minority.
Yeah.
Because I don't have cable.
Smart.
So I've looked hard. I've really looked, Alice. I've looked for references to gardeners on TV, on the radio, and any other medium. And even on the BBC, there are not, except for do-it-yourself shows, there aren't, the gardener as a profession isn't really in the mix in the world.
But even of those do-it-yourself shows, you know, it's kind of like this half-hour, like, guerrilla gardening, you know, budget is no problem, and
right,
just, you know, go for it, you know, quickly with, like, these silly people running around, you know, with,
yes,
with, like, braids.
Ground force.
Yeah. It's a little silly.
So other than that, kind of some of that silly stuff and the HG network, we're kind of invisible as a profession. So I asked the question, what does it mean to be a gardener today when most Americans in their daily lives, and especially in their professional lives, are disconnected from the land?
Oh, completely. We're so cubicalized.
Yeah. So, and I think that, you know, unfortunately, what I've observed is that getting your hands dirty is treated with condescension today.
Mm-hmm.
People think of any profession where you get dirty as low. And, you know, I understand where that comes from. So many of our ancestors worked so hard to get away from hard toil, to put on the white collar and never have to sweat again.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience has been that most people think of gardeners in a kind of simplistic term. Isn't he the guy who mows your lawn and trims your shrubs, right?
Exactly, right.
Well, of course, that's not my definition of a gardener. That underpaid and undertrained worker has made it possible for many people to have manicured lawns and shrubs, but not gardens.
Right. The garden has become out of vogue, out of fashion.
Yeah. So people think of landscapes as gardens, and that's not the same thing. So when you think about it, this group is usually referred to as my landscaper, kind of like my hairdresser or my manicurist. This person arrives, once a week at the end of their work, things look better and you don't have to worry about it for another week, right?
As if nature doesn't exist.
No, things stop and you don't have to think about it.
Right. Like it's a bathroom or a settee or...
Right. It gets cleaned and trimmed and, you know, like a shave and a haircut and that's it.
Two bits.
But, you know, that's not how gardens are made or maintained. And Alice and I always argue for this and we deal with this on a constant basis. With our clients, gardens are personal. They are not landscapes maintained to an inch of their lives by people who can't get better work for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And they require professionally trained individuals.
Right.
With strong backs.
appropriate plants for the appropriate site.
Right. And if you want to be a gardener, a professional gardener, you must know something about plants. You must know something about soil, about botany, about weather, about insects, and I argue ultimately about people.
Mm-hmm. It's science and art.
Yeah. And to be a good gardener, you have to be observant and curious and patient and nurturing and strong. You know, to tend to the needs of plants who are just like rooted there and they can't get a drink of water and they can't deal with the insects that are attacking them. It requires like what I think of sometimes as an archaic set of skills. Nobody has those skills anymore, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, that wasn't always the case. You know, there was a time when gardeners were treated with respect and the respect that I think the profession deserves. And that's sorely lacking today.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's been so diminished by underpaid people. And there is a place for those people, but you can't call them gardeners, you know? Now, I want to share a little bit to give some background about the profession, historically speaking. For example, going way back in ancient times, Roman gardens were cared for by the topiarius. He was the person in charge of embellishing and caring for the garden.
I want to see that on a business card.
Topiarius. Actually, we might have some
Carmen
friends.
Carmen DeVito. Topiarius. Extraordinaire.
Extraordinaire. So it is mentioned, actually, the first time the actual profession is mentioned is in a letter from Cicero to his brother in 54 BC. So when I said it's the second oldest profession, I wasn't kidding. Now, the clipping of plants, of course, formed part of the gardener's work even then. But he was also in charge of the topia, or place, the entire, all of the land, you know?
Estate garden.
Exactly. And, of course, the Romans had a great appreciation for nature and for food, as we know. And the profession actually was held in high esteem by the Romans. And, in fact, some gardeners put their profession on their epitaphs, on their gravestones.
Mm-hmm.
So that gave me an idea of what to put on mine.
Oh, boy.
Topiarius extraordinaire. Now, going forward a little bit in history, I thought this was very interesting. The importance of the qualities of the gardener is recognized in an early book on gardening. And I'm going to try to pronounce this man's name, but I'm probably going to butcher it. Jacques Boisseau de la Baroderie, Traite de Jardinage, from 1638. This is how he describes how you should choose a gardener. He says you should choose a gardener with the same qualities that we choose our plants. And I quote, "For just as we would choose for our garden young trees, with a straight stem of good origin, well provided with roots and of good stock, let us also take a young boy of good nature, good wit, and the son of a good worker," unquote. So obviously only men were doing this work then, but he also thought that the young gardener should be taught to read and write and to draw and paint, for his artistic gifts were as valuable as the purely horticultural.
So it's balance.
It's balance.
It's a balance.
It's very
work.
Interesting because when the majority of the population at that time in the 17th century were illiterate, he was thinking that gardeners should be literate and should be taught these other skills.
Right.
And,
well, it's geography, it's history, it's
science,
it's art, it's design.
Yeah. And when I was reading this, I was thinking Alice and I kind of have the same idea. Many of our best gardeners are artists. We have had painters on our staff. We have had musicians,
dancers.
Yep. Yeah. And they bring other qualities to the work.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So I agree with Baroderie's definition of what a good gardener consists of.
Well, I think balance is the, you know, it's the key to life, you know. That's like the cliche. But, you know, I think horticulture, it spans all aspects of
many disciplines
of what a good life should be and what you should, how you should value a life.
Yeah.
So, I think our society has become so entrenched in specialization.
I agree.
That
yes.
we've gotten away from
a broad knowledge.
The balance.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And the balance. Well, in the 17th century, there were guilds of gardeners actually, and they were regulated by statutes. And there was actually, at the Royal Nursery of Rule, they had a school for gardeners. And during that time, the status of the professional gardener was very high.
And this was like, what time period was this? Like 17th century or
yeah,
so?
Yeah, 17th century. In fact, André Le Nôtre, who was the gardener for Louis XIV, he was an outstanding example. I mean, not only did he maintain the gardens, but he designed them.
Mm-hmm.
He designed them, and he had a very big hand in the planning of it. The king left him, you know, a lot of leeway in that regard. In fact, Louis XIV very much valued gardeners. In his reign, one of the royal gardeners named Renard was supplied with a suit of livery to undertake a visit to Spain on the king's behalf. Perhaps he was looking for plants but he was actually considered of high enough import in the court to represent the king in another royal court. So I thought that was also very interesting. Not just in France, but also...
Right. He's not just some schlub.
No. He's not just mowing. You know?
Right.
Now, in England, of course, you know, they're not going to be bested by the French by any means in the area of gardening. They actually had a group called the Worshipful Company of Gardeners, which I thought would make a great name for a band.
Yeah.
I have to save that one. That group was recognized by the Royal Charter in 1605. But actually, its origins go back to the 14th century. So there were guilds, mm-hmm. like in other professions, that go back hundreds and hundreds of years.
An apprenticeship, and mm-hmm. right, that
exactly.
doesn't exist any longer.
No, and they started actually quite young, mm-hmm. you know. So the royal gardeners in France, in England, in Germany, in charge of these very large and elaborate gardens, were the senior members of their profession. Le Nôtre in France, Henry Wise in England, and P.J. Linnaeus in Germany, they combined the tasks of garden management and design to really high standards. I mean, today they would be considered landscape architects.
Yeah.
And many of them did not have any kind of real formal training or education.
Well, what's also interesting about today's, in contrast, today's landscape architecture profession is that a lot of landscape architects, while they're very adept at grading and engineering, they don't have a lot of experience with actual plants. And a lot of them have to go on to, you know, work in nurseries after their kind of architectural training.
Yeah, the horticulture part of their training is minimal
exactly.
compared to the, you know, the CAD drawing and the...
Grading, irrigation layout,
and drainage, and all that.
Yeah.
So,
so it's very interesting that
how it's evolved.
Yeah.
So, of course,
England.
going to 19th century England, the number of gardens, of course, grew because due to the Industrial Revolution, there were more and more individuals with money, and these rich families could hire gardeners. But what's interesting about the story for me is that not only were the gardeners in charge of the pleasure grounds, they were also in charge of the kitchen gardens,
mm-hmm.
which for many households, they were expected to produce all kinds of unseasonal fruit and vegetables. And they were also expected to grow and to maintain these new plants from the, you know, from the British colonies, plants that people had just begun to understand how to grow. So the gardener had to, you know, have cucumbers available in February for the
right.
family in the hothouses. And then they also had to grow begonias and cannas and callas and all these things where they really didn't understand how to grow them. They weren't native plants by any means.
Right.
So they were had to be very enterprising individuals,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And well-rounded.
Yeah.
I mean, you really have to understand the cultures and the temperaments and the zones and, you know, as well as the science and the art of it, too, because they had to be looking good.
Yes, exactly. All those bedding schemes in the Victorian era with those tropical plants, somebody had to lay those out. And
yeah.
it was the gardener. Although I'm sure the lady of the house, and you know, was involved as well at times. So, of course, in England, not just for private estates, but in municipal gardens, they started this apprenticeship program, and that continued for a very long time, up until the 1970s. But something happened in England in the 20th century. Municipalities ran out of money, and just like here in the United States, they just started putting these landscapes out to competitive bid.
Mm-hmm.
So the hand of the gardener, the skill, was removed, and that's why so many of our parks and public gardens went into disarray and disrepair,
mm-hmm.
because they just had people with very little skill
mm-hmm.
maintaining them.
Right, because they went for the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And the book rather yeah. than the knowledge, which actually, had they spent the money, the gardens would have been more sustainable and lived longer.
Yeah. And I'd like to share about one particular gardener who some of you might not know was actually a gardener. Some people think of him as an architect. His name was Joseph Paxton. And he started as a head gardener at this garden called Chatsworth in 1826. He was 23 years old. That means he probably apprenticed for 10 years before then. And while he, you know, is known as a gardener, he's also known as the person who built the Crystal Pavilion
mm-hmm.
for Queen Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
So he had no architectural training
mm-hmm.
except for his, you know, training in garden making and horticulture. And he designed and built the largest glass structure up to that point.
Well, that's years of observation and working in these public gardens that
And he basically taught himself architecture and science and engineering. Right. He taught himself that, which is pretty astounding when you think about that.
Yeah.
So.
Can you imagine people doing that today?
No, they want to clock out at 5. You know? They're in a union and they need to, you know, be paid overtime if they're going to do anything. Some of our friends in the botanical gardens have told us about that.
Yeah.
It's hard to get people to feel ownership of a thing. Now, the interesting thing, too, about it is that if you think, he made a lot of money. The most he ever made was the equivalent of about $50,000 a year at the height of his profession. $50,000 a year.
Yeah, but that's also 1826.
No, so. $50,000 in today's dollars.
Oh.
So he wasn't doing it for the money.
Right.
Obviously,
right.
You know? Now, of course, today there are many great gardening schools, especially in England. And also in the United States here at the New York Botanical Garden and at other botanical gardens.
Longwood Gardens. Has a great program.
You can. And the tide, I feel, is kind of turned. Public money is now being invested in public gardens. There are conservancies, like the Central Park Conservancy and Prospect Park Conservancy that are putting public garden, they're raising it to a new level,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
Bringing it back to how it was. And I'm very happy to say to see that. And I kind of want to close with something that I thought was a very interesting take on gardeners by Vita Sackville West, who was one of the most amazing garden writers and designers of the 20th century. This is how she describes gardeners. Gardeners, the most noteworthy thing about gardeners is they are always optimistic, always enterprising, never satisfied. They always look forward to doing something better than they have ever done it before. So those same qualities that make a great citizen, a great parent, a teacher, and a friend, I believe are developed when you're working with the handiwork of creation that gardens provide us. So I want you to get out there and get dirty. And as Cicero said, if you have a garden and a library, you have everything that you need. Now you're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about gardening as a profession.
See, the luck I've had can make a good man turn bad. So please, please, please let me get what I want. This time, haven't had a dream in a long time. See the life I've had.
Let me get Get What I Want from the Smiths originally, but this version from the band She and Him, that self-indulgent old ode to whining.
I want it.
And gardening as a profession. We're back from a short break and talking about the profession of gardening on We Dig Plants, Heritage Radio Network. Now, it's hard to have this discussion in the United States and not talk about Mr. Jefferson, the gentleman gardener, Mr. Thomas Jefferson, who created and advocated for the finest profession that one could ever hope to achieve, the self-sufficient gardener. So one quote that I love is by him, reads as such, "Those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God." So why is this, as a society, we're so far afield from agriculture?
No pun intended.
And from our hands in the earth in these modern times. Like, how did that happen? How do we get from, you know, this kind of doctrine of agriculture and creating a new land to being so completely
disconnected
from the earth?
And in only 200 years.
Yeah. That's what's so interesting. And why is it that we do not judge countries and societies by their farming methods anymore, and we judge them rather by their production methods? So there's a Greek proverb.
Their GDP.
Yeah. There's a Greek proverb that reads, "A society grows great when old men plant trees whose shade they know they shall never sit in." So is Congress today thinking of these such noble initiatives? And what will our American proverb or ideal be 2,500 years from now? That's my question. So Carmen and I face the proverbial request often in our business. Well, if I pay you cash, can I get a discount? How much to design the garden if I recommend you to friends? Can I get this planter at wholesale cost? And if I get smaller trees, how much will I save? But I still want total privacy and I don't want to see or know my neighbor.
Yes, it's amazing how many people in an urban situation don't want to see their neighbor.
Right, or it's suburban situation too. Mm-hmm. And so it just goes back to how land is used and how community doesn't exist. And I think horticulture and community are two very, very important fundamental aspects to the United States and therefore in this discussion of profession. Krev Kerr, in his Letters to an American Farmer, he waxed poetic about the virtues of farming, gardening, and self-sufficiency, and the virtues of these new lands in which to obtain these things. So this essay was really a fundamental document to the populating of the United States, and this was written back in 1782. So this was really one of the first examples of propaganda for the movement into the United States from Europe. So where is that document and that essay today, as contemporary homeowners are obsessed with building McMansions and saving as much money as possible on the landscaping, yet looking fabulous?
Yeah, I'm always amazed when I go to historic houses and I see with the exceptions of, you know, like the really giant ones, like of the Vanderbilts and such.
Right, where they have huge budgets.
Yeah, but most, even very wealthy people of the 18th century, 19th century, their home was modest compared to what they spent on the land and the landscape.
Exactly.
But now it seems to have reversed, doesn't mm-hmm. it, Alice? It's like a giant house as big as you can from property to property line with minimal thought to the outside.
Right. It's just basically rows of evergreen hedges. Cut yourself off from your neighbor. Don't produce your own food or vegetables. Don't have a kitchen garden. Drive to the store and spend your time indoors watching cable or, you know, playing video games. Or we're such a disconnected society.
There's an app for that.
Yeah. So the question is, where would we be without plants? And gardeners have the knowledge of plants, science, medicine, food, fuel. These professions are enhanced because of the work of gardeners and plant lovers and plant hunters and societies that valued plants and the profession.
Progressed.
Yes. So then, of course, because I've been trying to figure out how to kind of surmise this article that was written by Caitlin Flanagan in January's Atlantic Monthly. I hope you all have read it. If not, look it up. Because it's caused quite a stir in the gardening and in the food world. And the food world is really an extension of plant knowledge. So her essay was titled Cultivating Failure, which just floors me. Because is this the modern footnote then to Crèvecœur's Letters to an American Farmer? Is this the new propaganda against an agricultural life? Overall, she is arguing for school hours to be spent immersed in books and not into arts or school gardens or gym or fitness class or home ec or woodworking or metalworking or auto mechanics. She makes unbelievable statements as to what will happen if we promote gardens at schools. And basically, she says, we're going to become, it's a leap, we're going to become a nation of immigrant workers and laborers. Which I find astounding.
Oh, we should all become philosophers then, right?
Yeah, which I find astounding. Now, of course, let me also say that this educational argument is one that surfaces just about every generation. JFK, you know, had the big fitness push of the fad of the 1960s and the technical school classes of the 1970s. Mm-hmm. There's constant debate as to the best use of school hours and art and music, home ec, etc. But like plants, kids need a variety of stimulus for true education and balance. So the fad is now school gardens. But for Mrs. Flanagan, to assert that we're creating a society of immigrant agricultural workers flies in the face of all that we are as a nation of immigrant peoples founded in agricultural initiatives.
So what she's saying, Alice, is that if we
put too many dollars
into gardens during school hours, the kids are going to learn how to, you know, plant and pick fruit, and they're going to all run to California to pick
exactly.
And become agricultural workers.
Exactly.
As if there's no benefit, you know, to just learning where your food comes from.
Well, exactly. And as if it doesn't encompass geography and mm-hmm. math and science and, I mean, and literature. I mean,
well, just look to history. Look at the gardeners yeah. and what they were able to do. We were just talking about that 100 or 200 years ago. These were literate people.
Exactly. Much more literate than today. And that's what she misses in her article. And look at the victory gardens and the war gardens of World War I and World War II, which fed nearly 20 million Americans as agricultural labor had been pulled into military use. So because of that campaign, foodstuff production exceeded 1.2 billion by the end of the war. So the generations that came out of that era,
the baby boomers,
are also able to make a garden, grow their food, and produce the silicone chip for the handheld calculator. I mean, with this rampant critique of the type of Caitlin Flanagan's, we'll grow even further away from our roots. It's been just 60 years since those victory gardens, of which the school gardens were a part of, and now city kids here in New York City, when you take them on a field trip to the farmer's market, they don't even understand the role of the farmer. They think that their food comes from the supermarket. Like,
I know my son, who actually knows quite a lot about where food comes from, he's now obsessed with the iTouch. And he said to me, oh, there's an app. He's trying to get me into apps. And he said, there's an app that I know you'll love. It tells you when fruits are in season. And I said, I can tell by yeah. where the food comes from on the label when I go to the market. I know when it's in season.
Well, and, a lot of New York City kids, I mean, they go to the farmer's market and they're looking around for avocados and bananas. They have no idea of geography mm-hmm. and society upbringing. I mean, is this what our future is? Our future leaders that will be elected at some point to guide us? They're going to be looking for avocados, like a grown man looking for avocados in the New York
winter
farmer's market. So here's some figures that illustrate our history with farming and gardening as a profession. In 1900, in America, farmers make up 38% of the workforce. And the number of farms in the year 1900 is 5,740,000. 1950, farmers make up 12% of the workforce, and the number of farms is 5,388,000. So it's basically the same number of farms, but the workforce is less than half. So in the 1970s, farmers make up 4.6% of our workforce, and the number of farms drops to 2,780,000. So it's just chunking away and chunking away. 1987, farmland values bottom out after a six-year decline due to increased competition with other countries' exports. And in 2008, farmers make up 2% of the workforce, and the number of farms equals 2,002,000. So
it keeps on going down. NAFTA has something to do with that as well.
That's a whole other discussion.
Yeah.
But my point is that gardens, agriculture, and gardening are the mark of boldness and tenacity in describing a culture. It's longevity and place within the Earth's order. It's Italy, Greece, Britain. All these nations were founded on agricultural principles, on cultivating new lands, and a deep appreciation for how land is used and how it can be used. The farmer was the noble profession and an idealized vision or symbol for the success of a nation of self-sufficiency, community-minded, and prosperous. We unfortunately have lost our way, and with the style and the criticism of Caitlin Flanagan's kind, we grow further and further away from our roots. And she does us with this type of article as a nation. She's really doing us a disservice with these nasty remarks about the most noble profession. So what my question is, what would her Irish grandmother say of her success and these snotty agricultural commentaries? Can she ignore her Irish farming ancestry? Miss Flanagan? Call in. Cultivating Failure is the name of her article. And that's the essay that speaks to our future? Wow, that makes me a little speechless. It's an agricultural word, cultivate, that is inherently and by definition rooted in education, to cultivate. So how can she advocate one form over another? What about balance? It's like she has too much nitrogen in her soil. She's on overdrive and she's not focusing on her roots and her self-sufficiency. She's becoming dependent on other industrialized, mechanized forms of gardening, which is very, very sad. So then what should we be focused on? Greed and the best price? Industrialization? Mechanized food? Healthcare costs that run rampant? A bunch of rocket scientists and engineers that can't tell a rose from a tomato?
Oh, but they might be able to engineer a square tomato that would fit better in a box.
They have done that. That's not a joke. I mean,
and square watermelons, too.
Right, because it ships better, and therefore the price can go down. And, you know,
the bottom line is a nation needs to be able to feed itself.
Yes.
Okay?
And people need to be able to feed themselves. They need to know where it comes from, and they need to, in times of an emergency, you know,
be able to galvanize and work together.
Exactly. So we're so enamored with our money that we're actually forgetting the basic principles of good old-fashioned self-sufficiency and do-it-yourself mentality, which this country was founded upon. So to quote my new favorite author, Wendell Berry of good old Rolling Hills, Kentucky, he wrote in a wonderful book, we're shown, this is his quote, we are shown another farming family, three generations at the dinner table on their 130-acre Long Island farm, of which they have owned since 1737. These people, too, stand at a crossroads. Either they mechanize and expand, or rising costs, high taxes, and big farm competition will drive them from the land. There is not a word or implication or even so much as a doubt about the economic conditions that constitute this crossroads, not the smallest curiosity as to what may be the cost. Nearly 2.5 centuries of family history on the same farm amounts to nothing if they can't pay the taxes. So we're left with taxes. No acknowledgement of what that farmer has contributed to society or what he has created, how he has used the land.
It's how he's preserved it.
It's just taxes.
Mm-hmm.
That is unbelievable. So Crèvecœur probably influenced this family's move to this land. And now it's some kind of monotonous tract housing or some kind of Hampton estate or something because they sold out.
Well, they had to. If they when they pass the land on, they have to pay estate taxes at an exorbitant exactly. amount. So there's little protections
mm-hmm.
for
the,
that.
The profession of gardening really takes a backseat to hedge fund management and software engineering. But where will those guys and gals be should a disaster occur and food and medicine not be available? Turn to the lowly gardener. Now he's worth gold, right? Because he can make a fire, he can find and grow his own food, and he can survive. Gardening and agriculture is the fair weather profession? That's my question. Another Wendell Berry quote. We are in the crisis of character. The disease of the modern character is specialization. We must cleanse ourselves of slovenliness, laziness, and waste. We must learn to discipline ourselves, to restrain ourselves, to need less. To care more for the needs of others, we must understand what the health of the earth requires, and we must put that before all other needs. Our priorities, in my opinion, are misdirected and narcissistic. Wendell Berry, let me just back up for a second. Wendell Berry, that was a quote from his book, The Unsettling of America, Culture and Agriculture, which I recommend to a lot of people. So, Caitlin Flanagan, do you understand the reference? Narcissism? That's what Wendell Berry is speaking of. And if you want, Ms. Flanagan, maybe you could Wikipedia it, or you could learn it in the school garden, perhaps, as you study the bulb and how it regenerates. So the guy that mows your lawn, that clips your yews, of which so much of your medicine actually comes from, the yew, yeah. He might not be as stupid as you think. At least he'll be able to eat and make his wine and cultivate his soil and compost without causing disease and plague. And he'll remain healthy. You should be so lucky in your life of luxury. And don't ever underestimate the gardener. You'll need him one day, for sure. And remember, the gardener has big clippers. Chop, chop.
Well, we'd like to get your comments and feedback on all of our shows, especially this one. It's a powerful subject. It's a heavy subject.
It is.
And Alice and I don't usually rant or go off, but this is a subject that's very close to our heart because we've dedicated our lives to it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we want to increase the profession, increase its visibility, increase the respect for it, not just gardening, but agriculture in general.
And the knowledge that plants can bring to everyday life, which is balance.
Yes, and we're happy to care for people's gardens, but people should also know a little bit about
the profession and where it comes from.
And about their gardens themselves.
So that they can have better gardens.
Exactly. So, well, we'd like to thank you for listening to We Dig Plants again today on the Heritage Radio Network. Archived versions of the show are available via the website at heritageradionetwork.com or via podcast. You can leave comments at the archive show via the Heritage website or on our Facebook page, Groundworks Inc., We Dig Plants. We'd like to thank Jack Inslee for producing, Annette Wiener for engineering today's show. And we'd like to thank Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And to our sponsor, Whole Foods Market. And to Paul Watling of supercompuglobal.com for our theme music. Until next week, we will see you in the garden.
Happy gardening.
One, two. Don't stop your dreaming. Let yourself float upon an ocean. We can work it out. We can work it out, baby. Go ahead and lose yourself inside this house.